Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. We know that the most dangerous time for victims of domestic violence is when they leave their abuser. In today's episode, Sheila Bellish had been divorced from her abusive ex-husband for almost 10 years. And in those 10 years, his obsessive hatred and harassment of her never stopped. Like Sheila, Alan Blackthorne had remarried and had two other children, and yet he could never let her go. As his uncle later explained, Alan does not lose. And yet, he lost to Sheila, over and over again. And through the years, she grew stronger and even more resolved to fight Alan. When Alan gave up his parental rights to his daughters, Sheila thought it would all end. He could no longer use the girls as pawns. But he didn't stop. She had no peace. So she moved her family 1,200 miles away from him. And as soon as she was out of his grasp, he was incensed. He could no longer control Sheila. So she had to die. Welcome to episode 144, The Terrorizing, Stalking, and Murder of Sheila Bellish. Thirteen-year-old Stevie Bellish was older than her years. She had been through so much through her parents' vicious divorce and custody battles. And then, her mother suddenly moved their family from Texas to Florida. That would be hard on any teenage girl, to lose her friends when she's on the cusp of high school. The scariest time for a young teen, a time when everything changes. But as hard as it was, Stevie's life had actually started to stabilize. Things were looking up. On the afternoon of November 7, 1997, Stevie was rushing home to tell her mom some good news. She found out that a boy she liked was going to ask her out. She was finding her social footing in their new hometown of Sarasota. She was finally experiencing a level of normalcy she had never known in her young life. When she got to the front door, she was surprised to find it unlocked. Her mother had always been adamant that the doors had to be locked at all times. When they came home, they always locked the doors behind them. As she walked inside, she found her baby brothers and sister. Her mother and stepfather had quadruplets, and the toddlers were almost 2 years old. The babies were sobbing. She had never seen them cry like this. She began picking them up and trying to soothe them. They were naked except for life vests. Stevie's mother, Sheila, was always very careful about the babies and their indoor pool, so vests weren't that unusual. But they didn't have on diapers. And where was her mom? It took her a moment to notice that the babies had something red all over them, like red paint. She walked through the house calling out, "Mom, Mom, where are you?" She walked into the Florida room where the pool was and saw the diapers out on a table. The babies had clearly either gone for a swim or had been about to. She walked into her mother's bedroom, and still she couldn't find her. She was growing scared. Her mother would never leave the babies alone, not even for a minute. Stevie finally walked towards the kitchen. There were piles of clothes scattered on the floor. Her mother never left laundry on the floor like that. But something else looked off. It wasn't just the clothes. She was seeing more of that red. And then she saw her mother. Her mother was not a heap of laundry. Her mother was lying dead, soaked in her own blood. Stevie walked in a daze back to her mother's bedroom and dialed 911. But still confused and in shock, she hung up and walked back to the kitchen to look at her mother. She picked up the kitchen wall phone that had been off the hook and found that a 911 operator was on the phone. Even though she had hung up in the bedroom, the Sarasota County 911 system locked onto any phone lines that called in. At first, Stevie's voice was soft, my mom. As her voice got stronger, she became more hysterical. She managed to give her address and said, my mom is dead. Stevie gave her name, spelling Bellish for the operator, and saying her mother's throat had been cut. There was blood everywhere. She needed to call her stepdad, she said, but the operator said, no, you've got to stay on the phone with me and wait for the officers. Calm down and talk to me. Are you sure your mother is dead? Stevie sobbed yes. Her throat was cut. The operator kept her on the phone until the first responders were at the front door. The first deputy on the scene took Stevie outside. She was crying, but she seemed to be holding herself together for the four toddlers who now clung to her. The deputy asked Stevie, do you know who could have done this? Stevie said, quote, yes, I know who did it, but he didn't do it himself. He probably hired someone to do it. Who? The deputy prompted. My father did it. My father, Alan Blackthorne. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. Sheila Lee Walsh was barely out of high school, just 19 years old when she met Alan Van Hout. She was a lovely, petite blonde woman, 5'3", just over 100 pounds. Alan Van Hout, as he was still known then, was 6'2", darkly handsome, and completely charming and charismatic to Sheila as he leaned over her desk at the law office where she worked. She was working as a secretary for Alan's divorce lawyer as she saved up money for college. She thought it was Alan's first divorce, but it was actually his second. Sheila was naive and shy. Her father had been in the army, so she had moved around a lot when she was young. She had known poverty, living with her mother after her parents' divorce. Her mother, Jean, worked long hours waiting tables to support her family of five kids. Sheila was born on October 19, 1962, and had grown up mostly in Gulfport, Mississippi. She had two older half-brothers named Danny and Donnie Anderson from her mother's first marriage. Then Jean had married Frank Walsh, and she had four more daughters, Kathy, Sheila, Kelly Ann, and Carrie. Kelly Ann had died at only 19 days old. Sheila's sister Carrie was 5 years younger than her, but the two would always be the closest of friends. Jean soon divorced Frank Walsh as well. He had been an alcoholic and mainly absent husband and father. Then she married another serviceman named Don Smith. He had been in the Air Force, but he was much more stable. He had sons of his own and was happy to take on raising Jean's five children and their blended family. Frank Walsh was killed in Vietnam in 1972, and then Sheila's oldest brother, Donnie, died by suicide a year later. By then, the family was living in Salem, Oregon. That's where Sheila had gone to high school, and that's where she met Alan Van Hout. She agreed to marry him on their third date. Alan was worldly and glamorous. He took her to country clubs and all the nicest restaurants. He was 7 years older than Sheila, born in June of 1955. And he also pointedly courted Sheila's family. He told Don Smith that he had also been a serviceman, and that he had graduated from Stanford. The Smiths adored Alan Van Hout. Don handed over keys to his vehicles and boats to the young man. I guess Alan's charm was such that no one really did the math. At 26 years old, he said he already had an engineering degree from Stanford and had been a second lieutenant in the Army. Now, he was out of the Army and was already a successful young businessman. He owned a stereo store. I guess technically the math could work, though it would be a tight fit. But it was all a lie. William Alan Van Hout had been born in Eugene, Oregon, to his 16-year-old mother Karen and father Guy Van Hout. Alan's upbringing could literally be an episode all on its own, and I would probably title it How to Raise a Sociopath. Guy had been 2 or 3 years older than Karen, and when she gave birth to Alan, he deserted her. I think a good way to explain Alan Van Hout Blackthorne would be to compare him to his father. Guy Van Hout, also tall with dark features, would marry 5 times and father 9 children, though he only claimed 7 of his kids. Alan would marry 4 times, father 6 children, claim only 4 of his kids, before he gave up his parental rights to his 2 daughters with Sheila. Alan even looked just like his father. It's where he got his height and dark complexion. Both men had very dark brown eyes. He also had the same obsession and yet disdain and hatred for women that his father did. And of course, the same lack of caring for his children. For a full biography of Alan, I suggest reading Ann Rule's iconic book on this case, Every Breath You Take. Sheila's family and upbringing fit into 1 chapter, while Alan's spanned 3. After his father deserted him, his grandparents raised him for a while. And then his Aunt Debbie, his father's sister, and her husband, Tom Oliver, took him in when he was a teenager. This is the same uncle who would later say, "Alan always wins." When Tom and Debbie heard Sheila had been murdered, they called officials immediately to accuse their nephew of the murder. But back to my brief outline of Alan's youth, he had made the choice while living with his aunt and uncle to go live with his father, whom he barely knew, and his new stepmother and half-brothers. Debbie was worried, but probably also relieved. Alan's stepmother, Suzanne, later hated what he did to her family. Alan showed a penchant for hurting small animals while he was still young, and also an early obsession with women. He narrowly avoided a rape charge while still in high school. He also racked up several petty charges, some vehicular, some theft, always beating any jail time, and much of it was expunged when he turned 18. Alan also cross-dressed, often stealing his stepmother's lingerie. He would do this his entire adult life, though he never identified as transgender, gay, or bisexual. When police raided his home almost 30 years later with a search warrant after Sheila's murder, they found large-sized lingerie that did not fit his current wife. What Alan did like, though it was a closely kept secret, was to dress up in lingerie and have a woman dominate him. But before Sheila was introduced to this side of Alan, he first calculatedly separated her from her family. As I said, Don and Jean Smith really liked their son-in-law. They let him move into their home before he and Sheila had even married. Then Alan, the supposed young entrepreneur with an engineering degree from Stanford, talked Don Smith into going into business with him. Alan owned a stereo and video rental store called Capital Hi-Fi. Even though he had filed for bankruptcy after his divorce, which he blamed on his first wife taking everything, he managed to keep his store and had plans to expand to other locations. The Smiths had good credit and Don's Air Force pension. So they happily invested with their new son-in-law and had no idea what he was really doing. Because no one really knew Alan. They just believed him. The new business was called Stereo World, and by the time the Smiths realized it had failed, their credit was shot and they had to file for bankruptcy. Alan had moved their pregnant daughter Sheila and their baby granddaughter Stevie to Hawaii, leaving them holding the bag. The Smiths had completely trusted Alan, and now Sheila, pregnant with a toddler, was forced to choose. By now, she had started seeing the violent side of Alan, but she still somehow held out hope for her marriage. So she turned her back on her parents and moved away. The Smiths were left with nothing but their home, which had a mortgage on it. And then they had to leave the state to care for Don's ailing mother, leaving teenage Carrie behind with her stepbrothers. And Carrie would never desert her big sister, no matter what Alan did. And that included trying to rape Carrie when she was 15. Carrie didn't think Sheila would believe her, so she let it go. Alan had played it off like he had just been messing with her, and he did have a bizarre sense of humor, so Carrie tried to accept it. Many people in Alan's life would try to just accept him. He could be very charming. His father later called him the ultimate con man. Maybe Sheila would not have chosen Alan and ran to Hawaii if she had known about his first two wives and what he had done to Carrie or any of his prior convictions. She did know some things about him, just not the scope. Alan's first wife was named Ellen. She would later testify about her life with Alan. He married her right out of high school, and he was extremely abusive, hitting her, choking her, and even kicking her in the stomach when she was pregnant. He had made Ellen put up their first child for adoption, saying they were not ready to be parents. He also beat their dog to death for soiling the carpet. But his sexual proclivities were another form of abuse for Ellen. Alan often had his younger brothers over and liked to have sex in front of them. The brothers were shocked and embarrassed, and Ellen was humiliated. He also liked to be held underwater with his hands handcuffed behind his back until he climaxed, and Ellen said he would dress in women's clothes and have her drop him off in rough parts of town. The thrill being that he made it home later safely. At least, that's what he told her. When he kicked her in the stomach during her second pregnancy, Ellen chose to have an abortion and began making plans to get away from Alan Van Hout. Their marriage had lasted for 5 years. Alan would later try to deny the marriage, though the certificate was registered in Oregon, and of course, Ellen would later come back to haunt him during his murder trial. Guy Van Hout and Alan's brothers knew what Ellen suffered. They saw it directly. Tom and Debbie Oliver only guessed about Ellen. They could see the bruises, they could see her fear, but she didn't confide in them. Tom would later say Alan often drank to excess, while others in his life, including his father and even Sheila, would say he didn't like to drink because he didn't want to be out of control. Alan definitely showed different sides to everyone, but it's possible he learned about losing control while drinking during his early years while he still had contact with the Olivers. Alan married his second wife, a woman named Mary, in 1979 when he was 23. She had two small children, and Alan snowed her into believing he would be a great father to her children. Instead, he used them to control her, constantly telling her he would kill them if she left him. But leave him she did, sneaking away in the night after 3 years of marriage. She went to Tom and Debbie first, telling them how afraid she was. They knew his first wife, Ellen, had suffered something similar, and they gave Mary and her children a place to stay until she got on her feet. By now, Alan had little contact with his aunt and uncle, and probably didn't think Mary would run to them of all people. The Olivers said a couple of years later they saw Mary waiting tables in a restaurant while they were vacationing in California. She was terrified and begged them not to tell Alan where she was. They assured her they would never do that. It's hard to say how much they knew about Alan's marriage to Sheila. They were not invited to the wedding in February of 1983, but they did try to stay in touch, Christmas cards and whatnot. In the beginning, Alan bragged about his beautiful, blonde, and ambitious wife. He seemed to greatly admire her, but he could not hide his true nature for long. His deep-seated contempt for women always came to the surface. But he did see the lovely Sheila as a credit to him in the beginning, a possession. This was not real love, but Sheila did not initially understand that. She began seeing Alan's violent temper right away, though, even though he didn't hit her in the beginning. Something happened when she was 6 months pregnant with their first daughter that would terrify Sheila. She was in the car with him when he intentionally ran a man on a Harley motorcycle off the road. There had been a woman on the back of the bike who had been flung onto the roof of the car, and Alan swung the wheel wildly until she fell off and rolled into a ditch. Both the man and the woman died. Alan initially ran from the accident, but was scared he had been seen. He called his father, Guy Van Hout, who told him to go back, call the cops, and say the guy on the Harley had been the aggressor, and that he was only thinking of protecting his pregnant wife. Allen went on trial for leaving the scene of an accident without rendering assistance. But the trial ended in a mistrial when the jury deadlocked, and the DA declined to prosecute Allen again. He walked away scot-free after killing two people deliberately. And Sheila had seen the whole thing. Maybe it was this, and not her enduring love for Allen, that made her stay. She saw how he could manipulate people and get away, quite literally, with murder. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from today's sponsors. Today's episode of Southern Fried True Crime is brought to you by Simply Safe Home Security. Have you ever wanted to know what's happening at your home when you're not there? Then you will love the new wireless outdoor camera from Simply Safe. It lets you see what's happening outside right from your phone and alerts you when anyone approaches, so you always know who's there. Working from home means being alone a lot, and I really like having that camera at my fingertips for peace of mind. We have a camera out back as well, and when we're out of town, it's a relief to get the alert when our teenager pulls in the driveway after work. Simply Safe has everything you need to keep your home safe, from entry and motion sensors to indoor and outdoor cameras. Simply Safe is monitored 24/7 by professionals ready to dispatch police, firefighters, or EMTs to your home. Simply Safe is less than a dollar a day, and you can set it up in around 30 minutes. And there are no long-term contracts or commitments. You can customize the perfect system for your home in just a few minutes at simplysafe.com/southernfried. Go today and claim a free indoor security camera plus 20% off with interactive monitoring. Go to simplysafe.com/southernfried. February might be the shortest month, but I like to give my brain the maximum amount of me time. Best Fiends is my favorite way to treat my brain to a much-needed recharge. And I play Best Fiends with my stepdaughter. She's not living at home anymore, so it's a great way to stay connected. We are both at the 3700 level, so the competition is super fun. Best Fiends is a mobile puzzle game that anyone can download and play. Whether you have a few minutes or a few hours, Best Fiends is the perfect puzzle game to help you unwind. It features tons of cute characters who help you solve thousands of fun puzzles. The more you play, the more characters you collect. And the more you win, the more challenges you face. New characters and challenging puzzles are added all the time, and there are tons of events where you can win huge rewards. Mardi Gras Mayhem is going on for a limited time. In this tournament of champions, you collect compasses to climb the ranks of the leaderboard. Ready to give your brain some TLC? Download Best Fiends free on the App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. When Sheila first got pregnant, Allen seemed thrilled. He picked out two names, Stevie and Daryl, if it was a boy or a girl. He said it was for Stevie Nicks and Daryl Hannah. Other people thought it was strange, but Sheila just thought the names were cute. So Stevie Nicks Lee Van Hout was a month old when Allen went on trial for killing the Harley man and his girlfriend. A few months later, Sheila had a scare when diagnosed with spinal meningitis. She was in the hospital for a few weeks when Stevie was a baby, and Carrie later said Allen would not visit her, but also would not allow Jean to see her. Carrie cared for baby Stevie as Allen played golf, and the Smiths were bewildered about what was happening with their daughter. They had slowly begun realizing what was happening with the business, though Allen minimized it for a while. Then, he abruptly told them he had to file for bankruptcy. And it wasn't just the business that failed. Allen managed to put Don's vehicles and boats in his name and sold all of them. They soon learned that Allen had lied about attending Stanford and the Army. Don was able to save some of his things, but others he couldn't. And the Smiths had been close to retirement, and so they basically had to start over. And then they had to go to Mississippi to take care of Don's mother. As I said, Carrie stayed behind to finish high school, and she lived in the garage of the house as Don's son, her stepbrother, and his family took over the mortgage. But she worked three jobs and saved her money to go see Sheila as soon as she could. Her parents were brokenhearted, but allowed Sheila to cut them off. Carrie, however, insisted on staying in touch with Sheila. She would never give up on her big sister and always stayed by her side as much as she could. Alan had rented a house in Honolulu, and he was traveling in East Asia looking for his next big product to sell when Carrie visited. At this point, Sheila was pregnant again, and Carrie was alarmed to see how thin and shrunken her sister was. She told author Ann Rule that her sister looked like those photos of starving children in Africa that were in magazines so much in the 80s. Alan did find a product, a device that stimulated muscles with an electric pulse that made them contract involuntarily. He thought he could sell the devices to lazy Americans who didn't want to exercise. By now, he had brought his father, Guy, and one of his brothers, Randy, to Honolulu to join his business. Guy understood electronics much more than Alan, who did not, in fact, have a degree in engineering or anything else. Alan conned one of his sister's rich boyfriends into investing in the new Van Hout family venture. The new company was called Healthtronic, and Alan managed to get business loans worth $300,000 in Hawaii once it took off, despite his bankruptcy in Oregon. Guy would often brag that while he understood electronics, Alan was a born salesman. As business was supposedly taking off, Guy and his wife and Alan's brother witnessed Alan's abuse of Sheila. But they never intervened, even when he pinned a pregnant Sheila to the wall by her neck while her feet dangled. Carrie later said that even though she had seen bruises on her sister and was alarmed by her weight and general unwellness, Alan was smart enough to never abuse Sheila in front of her. For some reason, Alan knew the feisty Carrie would never put up with his shit. Maybe because she had actually fought him off when other women never could. Unlike with most people, Alan could not intimidate Carrie. Regardless, Carrie returned to Oregon, worried for her sister, but happy that Sheila had a full-time nanny, a sweet woman named Jonda, to help her. She was also glad that Alan's family was around, but didn't realize they never tried to help her sister. In Oregon, Carrie married her high school boyfriend, Rick Bladorn, who remained steadfast in his support of his sister-in-law right beside his wife. Daryl Hannah Lee Van Hout was born in July 1985 in Hawaii, just a few months after Alan's new business had ended in a huge scandal. After failing to get FDA authorization, Alan had still advertised the muscle stimulator as a health product. He was arrested and all his inventory seized. It was a huge scandal, and his father and brother were caught up in it. Of course, just like she had been when Allie ran that Harley off the road, Sheila was very pregnant and felt trapped when the scandal broke. In early 1986, while the FDA kept investigating and Guy and Randy tried to modify the stimulators to get FDA approval, Alan skipped town with Sheila and his two daughters, moving to Texas. Jonda, the nanny, moved with them. They moved to a small suburb of San Antonio, and it was then that Alan changed his name to Blackthorn. He claimed that he had found out that Guy Van Hout was not his real father, and his real father was some James Blackthorn. But Sheila knew he really got the name from the movie Shogun. It was a good way to throw off creditors and his father, as he once again started over, now in Texas. Soon he became furious, because Guy Van Hout, ever the phoenix just like his son, had managed to get FDA approval and was making a fortune on the devices that Alan had originally found. Sheila, who had worked as a personal assistant to a lawyer in Hawaii, like she had in Oregon, had excellent references and soon found a job in San Antonio with a new law firm. Jonda, the nanny, however, had enough of Alan after 6 months and moved to California. But despite her good job, it was around this time that Alan began to call Sheila a gold digger and hint that she had affairs. He even said that Daryl, who looked just like her mother, was not his daughter. He said that Sheila had an affair with her boss in Honolulu. It wasn't true. And it was a lie that would hurt and haunt Daryl most of her young life. Stevie had dark features like her father, though she did have her mother's delicate bone structure, but Daryl was Sheila made over, which made this lie easier for him. At this point in his life, which Sheila did not know, Alan had already given up one child for adoption, and later he had a child out of wedlock that he willingly paid child support for to keep her out of his life. It's sickening how Alan treated children like property. And he had another motive when naming his daughters with Sheila. It wasn't because he was a fan of Stevie Nicks or Daryl Hannah. He knew those names could pass for boys, and already had social security cards in those names to use in future scams. And all the while he was accusing Sheila, Alan was the one really having affairs. He even brought women home, having loud sex in their bedroom while Sheila huddled with her daughters in another room. He even brought a male sex worker to live with them for a while. Alan also liked to watch. Most of this, Carrie later told author Ann Rule, she didn't know about at the time. Sheila was too ashamed to tell her. And somehow, like he always did, Alan managed to get investors for his new venture called EMS Medical. He actually got back into business with his father, buying the new FDA-approved muscle stimulators. Alan's business was an almost overnight success. He traveled all the time, and he weirdly bragged about sex with prostitutes to clients and business partners, who all thought Alan was lying or just weird. Either way, he made money, and money smoothed over just about anything in Alan's world. By now, Alan's brutality towards Sheila had escalated terribly. She was aging prematurely. She looked sickly. But she was becoming resolute. She confided in Carrie that she wanted to leave Alan in early 1987. He once tried to drown her by holding her head in a toilet as he flushed it. In September of 1987, he began beating Sheila one night with a belt and then his fists, after some perceived slight. She finally managed to call the police. They took Alan in briefly. But in the end, he was charged with misdemeanor battery, which carried a $100 fine and no jail time. But in the short window when Alan was in jail before he bonded out, Sheila ran. She took her babies, put them in a car, and drove to California, to Jonda. She had stayed in touch with her former nanny and knew Jonda would take her in. Alan figured out her plan, hopped a plane, and met her in Jonda's driveway. As Jonda held the girls inside and screamed, Alan began beating Sheila in the driveway. A male neighbor saw what was happening and ran over to intervene. Alan then jumped in Sheila's car, running over the neighbor and crashing through Jonda's gate to her backyard. And then he took the car and ran. But of course, he would not leave California without Sheila, so he returned hours later. He was met by police and arrested for assault and battery. This time, it was a $425 fine and 18 months probation. The neighbor had lived and only had minor injuries, but still, it is incredible that Alan Van Hout, now Blackthorne, kept getting away with not only publicly beating his wife, but also assaulting other people. After his California arrest, Sheila ran to Oregon to be with Carrie. Carrie and Rick Bladorn hid Sheila and the girls, although Alan, always cowardly towards Carrie, would probably have not shown up there anyway. After a few weeks, Sheila gained some weight back, found her strength, and moved back to San Antonio. She knew that the only chance she had to keep her girls was to go back, retain her residency, and fight Alan in court. And she still had her job. Sheila's bosses had always admired her and valued her work, so they held her job for her. She found a small apartment in a complex that housed many single mothers, several escaping abusive relationships. She filed for divorce in the fall of 1987, and her first deposition that October was 100 pages long. She detailed all of his abuse and how often he told her he would kill her. Their divorce was finalized in September of 1988. Sheila got primary custody of Stevie and Daryl, her car, and $1,250 a month in child support. There was no alimony in Texas. Alan kept their house. Sheila didn't even fight for it, She just wanted out. And strangely, Alan didn't fight the divorce. Looking back on it all now, I think as long as Sheila had returned to San Antonio, where he could watch her, Alan would let her divorce him. He even offered to buy Sheila a house. The only stipulation was that it would be in his neighborhood so he could more easily see his daughters. Sheila was wary, but didn't think she could buy a home on her own, so she gave in. She soon regretted it. Alan bought little toy cars for the girls, now 3 and 4 years old, to ride down the street to his house. He started poisoning them against their mother. If Sheila said no, Daddy said yes. It only took 6 months for Sheila to realize it was a huge mistake, and to her relief, she did qualify for a tiny 2-bedroom house in another neighborhood away from Alan. So then he began to wage war with her over custody. It began when he failed to make child support payments. It was infuriating, because Sheila knew just how rich he was, but she had to continually go to court to make him pay to support his daughters. When she did, he would countersue for custody. This battle went on literally for years. Sheila always won, although Alan had made it his mission to find ways to beat the system. He pored over law books and was constantly trying to find a new way to terrorize Sheila in court. Once, Sheila realized he had dropped his payments down to $350. At first, she thought it was small back payments because he was always behind. But then she found out he had actually filed papers claiming poverty and won the ruling when Sheila didn't show up for court. It was outrageous how this man continued to play the court system. I'm not sure how a millionaire pleads poverty, but I suppose because he somehow hid the hearing from Sheila, that was all that mattered. She painstakingly refiled with the court and had her original child support order reinstated. She could legally undo whatever Alan did, but he never really paid her what she was owed. He had never sunk a dime of his own money into his company and almost skipped out on one of his investors, but somehow paid off that loan before he sold EMS Medical and started a new company called RS Medical. And while Texas didn't have alimony, they did have communal property. One of the other reasons Sheila had let the house go was because she wanted a percentage of his company when he sold EMS. He had started the company when they were married. She won 22%, but Alan had a gift for hiding assets, and in the end, Sheila only saw around $20,000 total when she was owed over $250,000. He hired a secretary named Virginia in 1991. Alan worked out of his home, and so did Virginia. Sheila knew that when Stevie and Daryl went to Alan's house, it was really Virginia who watched them, as Alan either traveled or played golf. So she tried not to worry too much about the girls when they were with Alan. And she was doing her best to move on with her own life. She was dating again and had met a man named Jamie Bellish in August of 1992. They married in June of 1993. Jamie was a very religious man, an ex-Marine and a pharmaceutical rep originally from New Jersey. Sheila craved the kind of stability and love Jamie was offering, and she was also eager to return to the church. And Jamie adored Sheila. On the night of their rehearsal dinner, Alan was supposed to return the girls after a weekend visit. Instead, a process server showed up at her dinner. She was handed papers that he was suing for more visitation. Only after she accepted the papers did Alan let the little girls go inside. He was outside in his car laughing. Sheila married Jamie the next day, determined not to allow Alan to ruin her wedding. But she did miss her honeymoon because she had to show up for a court hearing to fight Alan once again. He had orchestrated it perfectly. Alan met a woman himself in early 1994. Maureen Weingeist was the opposite of Sheila. She was dark-haired and dark-complected like Alan, exotic-looking, according to Ann Rule. Maureen was an executive for Hewlett-Packard and also had family money, so much so that her parents and her brother hired private investigators to look into Alan. But she would not believe her family, and she hired her own PI. Whatever she found out about Alan Van Hout Blackthorne, she married him anyway in May of 1994. Now Alan had an even easier way to hide money and torment Sheila. Maureen gave birth to Alan's son Brandon just months after their marriage in September 1994. Maybe that's why she still married him. And Alan soon found that Sheila didn't bother much with him anymore. She patiently fought him in court, but otherwise did her best to ignore him, which infuriated him. But soon, Sheila learned something horrible, and though she couldn't prove it, she figured out she could bring up the allegation and scare Alan off in court. He was sexually abusing Stevie. The little girl had begun saying sexually explicit things and making strange comments about how her daddy touched her. And then Stevie's daycare teacher called Sheila. The teacher said that on days Alan brought Stevie in, the little girl was withdrawn and actually smelled of sex. It took the teacher a bit to realize what that smell was on the disheveled little girl, but when she was sure, she told Sheila. Sheila was devastated and put Stevie in counseling. She knew she had to be careful about accusing Alan with her little girl in such a fragile state, so she waited and watched. The next time Alan filed a complaint in family court, she told him she planned to bring sexual abuse allegations. He dropped the suit. Thankfully, Stevie started realizing for herself what her father was doing and stopped going to see him on her own. Daryl, who Alan had always pretty much ignored in favor of Stevie, became his new pet. What she didn't know was that her father had now moved on to her. He was grooming her. Whether Sheila knew this was debatable. It's possible she only thought that he had focused his abuse on Stevie and that he was only paying attention to Daryl now to spite Stevie. The girls would later testify to beatings at the hands of their father. He threw them against walls in a rage. He often slapped them, pulled their hair, and beat them with belts. Once, when they accidentally clogged a toilet, he beat them with the shaft of a steel arrow, like from a bow and arrow. Sheila had certainly done all that she could to protect her girls in family court. She may have wanted to protect them from testifying if she had known about any abuse. And they may have been scared to tell their mother all of it. It's hard to say what she thought because at this point in her life, Sheila had become much more guarded. She wrote a letter to Alan that they should only speak through lawyers, and that stuck for almost 3 years, until she remarried, which fueled Alan's jealousy and rage towards her. But the girls were older now, 8 and 9 years old. Sheila probably thought they would tell her if something was happening. She was happy Stevie no longer wanted to go and did not force her daughter to see Alan. So, life continued on for Sheila, happy with her new husband. Jamie wanted children of his own, but Sheila had her tubes tied after Daryl was born. She never wanted any more of Alan's babies. At the time, she knew she would never get away from him if she kept getting pregnant. But now, with her new husband, she wanted children again. And with the help of in vitro fertilization, she was soon pregnant, with quadruplets. Typically, doctors recommend selective abortion in order to increase the chances that the other babies would be born healthy. The risk of miscarriage of all the babies was very high. But Sheila refused. The Bellishes were extremely religious and categorically against abortion. Sheila had grown up in the church, but had mostly lost her faith when she was with Alan. With Jamie, she started going back to a Baptist church and devoted herself to her husband and her faith. As I said, Jamie Bellish was a sales executive with Pfizer. He made a really good living. Sheila sold her little house and Jamie sold his bachelor house, and they bought a new big house in a nice neighborhood with a pool, jacuzzi, and plenty of bedrooms. What they didn't know when they bought their dream home was that they were moving next door to the worst kind of nosy neighbor. But in the beginning, they didn't know. Sheila carried the babies, but had to be hospitalized 4 months before the babies were due, and stayed there on strict bed rest until the babies were born via planned cesarean in December of 1995. They had 3 little boys and 1 little girl, Frankie for Sheila's dad, Joey for Jamie's dad, Timmy for St. Timothy, and little Courtney, the smallest of all. Sheila and Jamie became local celebrities for the quadruplets, and according to Ann Rule, Jamie planned out publicity carefully to get ahead of it once the babies were born. It was controlled chaos, as he put it. Carrie came to visit Sheila and the babies and was 7 months pregnant herself at the time. Also, according to Ann Rule, it was when Sheila was pregnant with the quads that she confided her fears to Carrie. O.J. Simpson was acquitted of the murders of his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and Ronald Goldman, just as Sheila was entering the hospital on bed rest in October 1995. Sheila told Carrie that since O.J. got away with it, Alan would probably now believe that he could kill her and get away with it. Carrie was horrified, but Sheila made her promise that if anything ever happened to her, she would look after her children. And she made another bizarre request. She wanted Carrie to find Ann Rule and tell her Sheila's story if Alan ever murdered her. Carrie kept her word, and Ann Rule did one day tell Sheila's heartbreaking story. I'm going to pause now to hear another word from today's sponsors. Today's episode is brought to you by BetterHelp Online Therapy. Relationships take work, and some of us forget that the most important relationship of your life is the one you have with yourself. You will probably drop anything to help someone you care about. Why is it we go out of our way to show up for others, but sometimes ignore our own needs? So this month, BetterHelp Online Therapy wants to remind you that you matter just as much as everyone else does, and that therapy is a great way to make sure you show up for yourself. Therapy has gotten me through some of the hardest times of my life, but also, I consider therapy like regular maintenance for my mind and my heart. And BetterHelp makes it so easy to stay in touch with myself and my needs. BetterHelp is online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can be matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. Give it a try and see why over 2 million people have used BetterHelp online therapy. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and Southern Fried True Crime listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/southern. That's BETTERHELP.com/southern. Thrive Cosmetics are high-performance beauty and skincare products made with clean ingredients. I love how easily Thrive fits into my daily routine, from their skincare to makeup. Thrive makes me feel beautiful without any hassle, like their waterproof eyebrow liner. It's for naturally defined brows that may have been overplucked or become sparse over the years. My brows were the victims of the early aughts style of skinny brows, so Thrive's Infinity Waterproof Eyebrow Liner is perfect for me. It blends like powder, but holds like wax, helping my brows look natural again. And as I've told you, I use the Brilliant Eye Brightener daily. The cream to powder highlighter is so much easier to apply than conventional eyeshadow. And the best part is Thrive's bigger than beauty mission. For every product purchased, Thrive Cosmetics donates to causes that help women thrive, like women who are emerging from being unhoused or fighting cancer. This is where the cause in Thrive Cosmetics comes from. Now is a great time to try Thrive Cosmetics for yourself. Right now, you can get 15% off your first order when you visit thrivecosmetics.com/southernfried. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS.com/southernfried for 15% off your first order. The Bellishes were happy in their new home for a while. There were definitely early issues with Jamie, who had never been a father and was very strict. Stevie and Daryl had grown up with a father who let them do whatever they wanted to do. He encouraged bad behavior. If they made a mess, he told them not to pick it up. They had maids for that. His moments of anger and abuse did not outweigh much of his permissiveness in their young eyes. He bought them every toy they wanted. Little Stevie, before she was even 5 years old, would threaten her own mother if she didn't get her way and say, "Daddy says we'll just go to the judge." Of course, all that had now changed. But Stevie and Daryl had been through so much. And now, there were 4 new babies taking up their mother's time. The girls, now almost 12 and 13 years old, began acting out. And Jamie Bellish was religious in the sense of spare the rod, spoil the child. He spanked them with belts and wooden spoons. He later had to admit in court that he once said hands were for love and objects were for punishment. Sheila may not have liked it, but her sister and others knew that at this point in her life, she was reaching her wit's end with the girls. Entering adolescence, they were very rebellious. Maybe she thought Jamie's way was better. Their new neighbors, the Adays, seemed to be friendly in the beginning. Pat Aday was a very motherly woman and was friendly to all the neighborhood kids. Soon enough, Daryl started to run over to Pat's house whenever her mom or Jamie made her mad. In March 1997, Daryl ran over to Pat's when her mom threatened to spank her. Pat called Alan and the police. Alan rushed over, dramatically taking Daryl, and the police left when they found out that Daryl had not been hit. But CPS was called in because of allegations Daryl made about her stepfather. The CPS workers did find out that Jamie Bellish used belts and spoons to spank his stepdaughters. Everyone was ordered into counseling. Jamie, who had firmly been raised that way, struggled, but he followed the rules. CPS did not feel that he was overtly abusive, but he needed counseling. Jamie and Sheila agreed. Stevie still got angry at Jamie sometimes, but she still didn't want to see Alan. But Daryl was different, because Alan was grooming and manipulating her. After that March day, Daryl was constantly running to Pat Aday, and Pat Aday became Alan Blackthorne's new friend. She spied on the Bellishes, constantly calling Alan. In the spring of 1997, Alan met a man named Danny Rocha at his country club where he played golf. He started hanging out with him a lot, and for his birthday, Maureen bought Alan golf lessons with Danny. Rocha was a full-time bookie and mainly hung out and bet on golf holes, but fancied himself a pro and gave lessons. Soon, Alan had struck up quite a friendship with Rocha, and he had started talking about his ex-wife a lot. He took Danny Rocha on a golf trip to Oregon and got messy drunk on the plane. Rocha would later say this was the first time Alan asked him about hiring him to hurt Sheila. He said really vicious things, like he wanted her left blind in a wheelchair, unable to care for her kids. Rocha just tried to blow it off in the beginning and let Alan rant. Meanwhile, Maureen had another baby named Jake. She and Alan bought a new 9,000-square-foot mansion in an upscale neighborhood. They spent thousands decorating their house, but neighbors said they mostly lived in their garage where they smoked. They awkwardly tried to make friends with neighbors, none of whom could stand them. They were that obnoxious couple that everyone hates. Alan became a fixture, sitting in a recliner in the driveway right outside his garage, just people watching and smoking. And he started telling anyone who would listen that Sheila Bellish was abusing his daughters. In June of 1997, he filed a contempt of court motion against Sheila because Stevie had stopped coming over to see him. But after the incident with Pat Aday, Sheila was finished. This time, she sued back for a protective order against Alan and an increase in child support. She brought in the counselor she had taken Stevie 2 years ago, who planned to testify to the sexual abuse and recommend only supervised visitation with no overnight stays. This was it. Sheila had never wanted to risk Stevie having to testify, and she hoped it wouldn't come to that, but she was finished with Alan's constant court battles. When Alan realized what she planned to do, he shocked his lawyer and the judge by not only abruptly dropping the suit, he said he wanted to give up all parental rights to his daughters. His lawyer and the judge tried to counsel him against disowning his daughters, but Alan was resolute. There was no way he was going to risk the sexual abuse charges coming out. And he probably knew that not only would he never have to pay for child support again, or college, or anything else for his daughters, he could still manipulate them, even if it was later in life. And he didn't have to wait long with his new friend Sheila's nosy neighbor, Pat Adey. And his friendship with his golf instructor was only becoming even more transactional. Danny Rocha realized something Alan never seemed to be able to admit to himself. Alan Blackthorne sucked at golf. He was terrible. He would bet Danny thousands of dollars on a single golf hole. Alan lost tens of thousands to Danny in a week. At this point in his life, Alan was basically a retired millionaire. He let Maureen handle all his finances and the running of the company, and he spent his days on the golf course. Many people have always wondered about the very strange Blackthorne marriage. Maureen seemingly did something no other woman in Alan's life could do: control him. Anne Rule wrote of an incident early in their marriage when Maureen called Sheila screaming and crying, and Sheila calmly told her, "I tried to warn you," and hung up on her. Carrie was there at the time and witnessed the call. And it was true. Unlike Alan's first two wives, when Sheila found out Alan planned to marry again, she called Maureen and asked her to lunch. She warned her about her abusive ex-husband. Not just about the abuse, but about his affairs, the cross-dressing, his penchant for masochism and humiliation. Maureen was cold to Sheila, and then she told Alan everything Sheila had said. He flew into a rage, but nothing ever came of it. There was one recorded incident in Alan and Maureen's marriage early on while she was still pregnant with their first son. It came out in court that she had $100,000 of family money that she brought into the marriage, and Alan had wanted her to invest it in his company. A fight ensued, and she called the cops. But once they arrived, she sent them away. Whatever else happened that day, Maureen Blackthorne gained control of her husband's finances. I don't think Alan minded, because it made it much easier for him to hide money from Sheila. A few years and two sons later, Maureen and Alan seemed to have a solid marriage. She let him golf all day as long as he was home for dinner. If there were affairs or any of his other normal sexual activities, they kept it between themselves. As I told you earlier, a search warrant after Sheila's murder would turn up large lingerie, not Maureen's size. It was believed Alan did still enjoy cross-dressing. They also found all kinds of sex toys: dildos, whips, cattle prods, lubricant. The list went on and on. So maybe Maureen was into all of that. I want to be clear that I am not kink-shaming. Whatever else the Blackthorns had, this seemed consensual. It was what he put his first three wives through sexually that was abusive. Anne Rule reported that Maureen had tried to sue Hewlett-Packard for sexual harassment not long after her marriage to Alan, for how male executives spoke to her and around her. Because the Blackthorns wanted more than what was essentially Maureen's $100,000 dowry. They probably thought HP would settle, but the company went in for a fight. HP hired investigators who found that Maureen was the one who behaved in a bawdy manner. She had multiple affairs with coworkers. So Maureen was fired without any sort of settlement or benefits after this. She now had to go all in with Alan Blackthorne and RS Medical. So I guess she decided to take over. They seemed to be a very close couple, always seen holding hands and lighting each other's cigarettes. They constantly chain smoked. And they were awkward and irritating to people they tried to befriend. And it was around this time that Maureen started calling Sheila the black cow. Cow, because of all the babies she had carried. Her jealousy and hatred for Sheila grew as much as Alan's. Later, the conspiracy to murder Sheila would be called by the code name Black Cow. Alan had already started talking to his good buddy Danny Rocha about having Sheila beat up. Danny supposedly thought he was joking at first, but he certainly didn't want the cash to stop flowing, so he kept entertaining Alan's plans. Meanwhile, Daryl was still sneaking and calling Alan whenever she could. She and Stevie were not supposed to have any contact with Alan after he gave up his parental rights. When Pfizer wanted Jamie Bellish to transfer to Sarasota, Florida, he and Sheila jumped at the chance. Now that Alan had disowned the girls, they didn't have to stay in Texas. and Pat Adey had ruined their happiness in their new home. And it wasn't just about the girls. The Adeys were constantly fighting over property lines and silly things. Pat had huge spotlights installed that shone right into Sheila and Jamie's bedroom. And Sheila had never really let her guard down. She probably knew that Alan was biding his time, planning something. It had all seemed too easy when he gave up his parental rights. So August 31st, 1997, Sheila and Jamie went to look at rental houses in Sarasota, just until they could build their dream home. A sitter was left with Stevie Darrell and the Quads. When they got home, Sheila found out from the sitter that Darrell had gone to see Alan. She was furious. She didn't want Alan knowing anything about their lives, especially about the fact that they were moving soon. She whipped Darrell herself with a belt. She only hit her once before she put the belt down. But that was enough. Darrell ran to Pat Adey. Pat called Alan and let Darrell speak to him. He encouraged Darrell to exaggerate the beating. She later testified that he told her it didn't sound all that bad unless she exaggerated it. Pat took photos of what she said was a welt on Darrell's leg. Darrell also claimed her mother had slapped her. Sheila was arrested and charged with felony child abuse. To Alan's delight, it made the evening news. Quad mom arrested for child abuse. Sheila hung her head in shame on camera. Alan recorded all the news reports and had his secretary, Virginia, make copies. He planned to mail them to Sheila's new friends, neighbors, and Jamie's bosses. What Darrell had not counted on in this situation is that she couldn't actually go to Alan's after she called the police. He was no longer her parent. She was sent to a juvenile facility while the whole thing was sorted out. It was awful. I am not condoning corporal punishment. I am very much against it. I was not raised with it myself. But I know from threads in my Facebook group that people still have very different opinions on corporal punishment. The point here is that Sheila had very much struck her child in anger and frustration and probably fear. And then she very much regretted it. She was released on bail and promised to be back for her September 15th court date. Unfortunately, Darrell had to stay in juvenile detention until the investigation was complete. CPS workers investigated and found that Darrell was well-nourished. They did not find any bruises and just one scratch on her. They did not believe Sheila was a chronic abuser. They also saw that the Bellishes were willingly in family counseling. They believed that Sheila had just been trying to discipline 12-year-old Darrell in what was obviously an extremely stressful family situation. But the problem was, Sheila refused to talk to them. She was afraid to do it without an attorney. They decided that Sheila could leave the state, and Darrell would stay in custody until she returned for her court date on the 15th. And now, Sheila and Jamie packed up and fled to Sarasota in the middle of the night. Pat Adey called Alan as she snooped out her windows, saying, "Something is going on. I think they're moving." Jamie got one U-Haul and had friends come over to help them load it up quickly. Sheila did return on the 15th for her hearing, and Darrell was released back into her custody and allowed to return with her to Sarasota. But Sheila insisted that a caseworker fly back with them. She was so terrified of losing Darrell to the state. She knew her poor daughter was an angry, hurt, and confused girl. Alan had relished in telling his daughters, against the judge's order, that he was no longer their daddy. They were both really hurt and angry. Sheila didn't know what Darrell might do next. When they got to Florida, Darrell was taken to a YMCA to live until the family could get further counseling. Darrell was understandably devastated. Her father had manipulated her. She had never meant for it to go this far. But Jamie was now afraid to have her in the house, and Sheila was also terrified that Darrell would give Alan their new address. The Bellishes had been very careful, They had many friends in San Antonio, and they only left them with a forwarding P.O. box as an address. Very few people knew where they actually lived. It's almost like Sheila knew that this was the most dangerous time for abused women. If she left Texas, Alan would probably kill her. He had to keep her under his thumb. It was almost 1 month to the day, 10 years ago, that she had filed for divorce from Alan. And yet, it was like she had just left him. And she wasn't wrong. Alan hired a private investigator to look for Sheila. He called her bail bonds place and tried to turn Sheila in for skipping bail, but they knew that she had left town. She had promised to call in and check with them. She kept her word, and they had no issues with her. So then, Alan asked for her address. What he didn't know was that the bondsman recorded all calls, and this whole conversation would later be played in court. He acted like Sheila owed him money and was skipping out on a civil suit, and he needed to find her to serve her papers. But this wasn't their first rodeo. The woman who answered the phone at the bond office played along with Alan, seeming sympathetic. "I'm sorry, sir. I wish I could tell you where she is, but it's against our policy." He kept her on the phone for over 15 minutes, but it didn't work. The smart woman would not give him one detail about his ex-wife. And his private investigator had only turned up the P.O. box. Alan told him to go find Baptist churches and stake them out looking for the Bellishes. Chuck Chambers, the PI, said he would keep trying. But Alan still had one ace in the hole, his daughter Daryl. Sheila didn't know that Alan had set up an 800 number for his daughter to call and had her memorize it. It was almost like he knew it would come to this. Daryl called him all the time from the Y. Lonely and confused, she cried to her dad, who kept on manipulating her. He constantly asked her for her new address. While Daryl had been on several visits to the new home, she didn't actually know the address. And she had a sinking feeling. She knew she wasn't supposed to call him, and she knew she probably shouldn't tell him. But Alan finally wore her down. He promised he would come see her for Christmas, sooner if he could, but he had to know her address. She admitted that she didn't know the whole address, but that it was Mark Something Road. So he asked her for landmarks. "What can you remember, Daryl? Is anything close to the road?" Daryl remembered a florist and a supermarket. "Very good," her father told her. And then he hung up and called Chuck Chambers with the new information. Daryl never heard from her father again. And she never saw him again until she faced him in court when he was on trial for having her mother murdered. I'm going to pause now to hear a final commercial break. Armed with the new information from Alan, Chuck Chambers was pretty sure he had the address. To be sure, he sent one of his employees over to act like he was delivering flowers and had the wrong address, and Jamie Bellish did open the door. He called Alan Blackthorne back with the address and received his credit card for payment in full. He had no idea what he had just done. There are a lot of private investigators who won't work divorces or custody cases. I'm not sure if Chambers ever said if Alan had to coerce him or just say that he was looking for his children. But he was quoted as saying his blood turned to ice when he saw that Sheila had been murdered on the news. He knew exactly how hard she had been to find. On that horrific November afternoon, when 13-year-old Stevie called 911, investigators were soon crawling over the house as news cameras caught Stevie sobbing while hugging Jamie outside on the front lawn. Investigators photographed the babies after EMTs made sure they were not harmed and before they released them to Jamie. They had their mother's blood all over their little feet and legs. Sheila had been dead for hours. The pools of blood around her were already drying. The babies had likely wandered around their dead mother crying for hours until Stevie came home. Along with the diapers in the Florida room, they found remnants of the breakfast Sheila had bought for the babies from McDonald's. Based on the coroner's estimate, they thought the babies had been home for up to 7 hours alone in the house with their mother. Timmy, the most verbal of the babies, cried that Mommy had a bad boo-boo and the man had done it. He actually had blood on the inside of his little life jacket. Investigators made the horrific assumption that he had probably been clinging to Sheila's leg when she was attacked, bleeding directly down onto her baby. From the blood trail, the attack started in the laundry room and went through the kitchen. Sheila had been shot in the face with a .45 caliber bullet. The bullet entered her cheek and exited out the back of her neck. She dropped to her knees so hard that bruises were left behind. But she wasn't dead yet. She had staggered up and tried to make her way to the kitchen wall phone. Her killer grabbed an 8-inch butcher knife from a metal knife block hanging high on the wall and then slashed at Sheila's throat. She fought hard, with one stab wound going through her hand all the way to the bone. She had 2 slashes on each side of her neck, both cutting her jugular veins, but not her carotid artery. The coroner said that if she had gotten medical intervention in time, she could have survived. But her killer left her dying, bleeding out on her kitchen floor, with her 4 babies sobbing around her. She had managed to pull the phone off the hook before she fell straight back, with 1 leg bent beneath her. Investigators found a fingerprint in Sheila's blood that was unidentified. There was also a man who owned a landscaping company in the neighborhood that day. He had seen Sheila's killer. He was mowing yards in the area near the Bellish home when he saw a white Mitsubishi pull up that he knew didn't belong in the neighborhood. He watched as a huge man in camouflage got out of the car and headed in the direction of Mark Ridge Road. The man was terrified and tried not to look directly at the strange man, but managed to memorize his license plate. The plate was registered to an elderly woman in Texas, in fact, the killer's grandmother. Once they had a name, they ran the print and got a match. 21-year-old Joey Del Toro. I honestly wavered quite a bit on how to structure this script. I probably could have split Sheila's story into 2 or even 3 episodes. But I will tell you bluntly, the conspiracy to murder Sheila was not nearly as compelling as what led up to it. The details of his horrific abuse of Sheila and his daughters paints a much more vivid picture of the controlling and hate-filled man who had orchestrated her brutal murder. It took 31 months to states and federal prosecutors to bring Alan down. He was bold enough during this time to even go on 48 Hours on CBS. He smiled gregariously, calling himself a husband, father, and golfer. He admitted to striking Sheila once during their marriage, a mistake he regretted. He insisted he had nothing to do with her murder. But his conspirators gave interviews as well. All of the CBS articles, as well as local news, are in my sources, and of course you can still watch that 48 hours if you want to feel like punching someone. In essence, Alan would claim that Danny Rocha set him up, killing Sheila to extort him, which, honestly, if you think about it, is so ridiculous, considering Rocha was making a fine living just whipping Alan's ass on the golf course. No, Alan constantly nagged Rocha, offering more and more money all the time. Rocha said he would not beat a woman, but he would hire someone who would. He enlisted 27-year-old Sammy Gonzalez, a caddy at the country club where they golfed. Alan initially gave Rocha $9,000, and in turn, Rocha gave Gonzalez $4,000. But Sammy Gonzalez also did not want to hurt a woman, so he tapped in his 21-year-old cousin, Joey Del Toro. The newspapers say a lot of glowing things about Joey's past. He was a football star, popular, dated the prom queen, aspirations of college. but he had no real guidance, they said, and lived with his grandma. Maybe Joey was those things in high school, but at 21 years old, he had a daily cocaine problem and apparently no qualms about hurting a woman. He was a big, hulking guy, standing over 6 feet tall, and had lost none of his football player muscles despite his daily drug habit. It's sickening to think of this huge man attacking tiny Sheila Bellish, who stood 5'3" and weighed 107 pounds when she died. And she had died on her feet fighting. Del Toro had been arrested for shoplifting in April 1996 and was on probation, serving a 30-day sentence on weekends. He didn't show up on the weekend Sheila was murdered. And that was why his prints were on file. By the time Del Toro was in the conspiracy, Allen promised Rocha $50,000 if he could get his daughters back, and the only way to do that was to kill Sheila. He provided a photo to Rocha that was passed on to Del Toro through Gonzalez. It was a picture of Sheila holding little Stevie at a birthday party at a pizza place back when Allen and Sheila were still married. In a later search of Allen's house, the full pack of photos of this party were found, and one was missing, though the negative was still there. It was the photo Allen had given to Rocha that was eventually passed to Del Toro. That single piece of evidence would be particularly bad for Allen. Joey Del Toro, coked up, with a start of $500 in his pocket, traveled 1,200 miles with Sheila Belush's photo. He was an incredibly stupid hitman, using his own ID to check into a motel and being seen buying camouflage clothing. Then he asked for directions to Markridge Road, where the Bellishes lived. He later claimed that he broke into her house and watched her from the garage and had decided to leave when he saw that she was a good mother to her babies. He said he had been told he was going to beat up an abusive mother. But then Sheila saw him and he had to shoot her. I personally think that story is bullshit. He surprised her coming into the utility room from the garage, and when he shot her, he had a towel over the muzzle of the gun, hoping the shot wouldn't be heard. That towel wound up jamming the gun so he could not shoot her again when she stood back up, trying to fight her way to the phone for help. So then he grabbed a butcher knife and viciously attacked Sheila before leaving her bleeding out on her kitchen floor. Sammy Gonzalez was the first to make a deal. He later claimed he only made $20 off the whole thing, giving Joey all the money Danny gave to him. He got 30 years in Texas and 19 in Florida for his testimony. He was released from Florida in 2014, and Haley did not find him in the Texas prison system. His Texas sentence may have been suspended for his cooperation. Danny Rocha decided he would wait for a better deal than Sammy's. He miscalculated how much the state wanted all the conspirators in prison. They murdered a woman in front of her four children. Danny Rocha was not walking with immunity to flip on Allen Blackthorne. After Sheila's murder, Joey Del Toro had driven back to Texas and stayed with an old girlfriend in Austin. There, police found his bloody clothes, his hotel key card, and the gun he used. But by then, Del Toro had already fled for Mexico after Gonzalez gave him the rest of the promised money, $3,500. And he successfully fought extradition for over a year, even though he should have been outright deported since he was an American citizen. It took so long that politicians got involved to review our extradition treaty with Mexico. Many wondered how Del Toro was bankrolling all his Mexican appeals, or if Mexican officials were taking bribes. They would later learn from Danny Rocha that Allen had vowed to pay for attorneys if anyone was caught. It would seem he kept his word. After a congressional hearing was called to review the treaty that had been in place since 1978, Mexico finally gave Del Toro up. Jamie Bellish and Carrie Bladorn had testified at the hearing, furious that Sheila's killer was being protected. Del Toro originally went to trial, but at the last moment he took a plea deal for 2 life sentences, crying and begging forgiveness to a furious Jamie Bellish, who was shouting that he wanted Del Toro's family to see photos of what that man had done to his wife. It might have taken over 2 years, but all those agencies working together put together a massive case against Alan Blackthorne. They went through thousands of phone calls, letters, and of course, tying it all in with Sammy and Joey's stories. Danny Rocha would go to trial, but at the 11th hour, realizing he was screwed, he took a deal to avoid the death penalty and also turned on Alan. He was sentenced to 2 life sentences, though he continues to change his story and fight in new appeals. Everyone eventually turned on Alan, including his longtime secretary, Virginia. Alan had thought he kept her under his thumb, and he co-signed a car note for her. When he refused to give her the title, she quit and testified to many damning parts of the conspiracy. When the search warrant was served on the Blackthorne house, the tapes Alan had Virginia make of Sheila on the news after the child abuse charge were found in Virginia's files. She had never mailed them. Also, a maid named Celia had basically been working as a slave for the Blackthornes, waiting to get citizenship. Alan and Maureen held her immigration papers, and when she finally confronted them, Alan literally threw her out of the house without a penny, strewing her clothes and few belongings all over the yard as the sprinklers ran and soaked everything. He later tried to deny this, but neighbors saw it, and one neighbor called a cab for the sobbing woman. She was later able to testify to how much the Blackthornes hated Sheila and talked on the phone about her. I'll never understand how authorities never charged Maureen in this conspiracy. They had quite a lot on her in phone and paper trails. She called the private investigator and other tangentially connected people. But she never spoke directly to the men who eventually killed Sheila. When the search warrant was finally served on them, investigators found a veritable war room in their garage. They had photos, news clippings, and charts taped to a wall. You would think Alan and Maureen would have been smart enough to get rid of incriminating evidence, but actually, the evidence in their garage showed that they were reveling in the fight to keep Alan out of prison. Before Alan was arrested, he had moved all his stock, supposedly worth some $50 million, as well as any cash in bank accounts, all into Maureen's name. In November 1998, Jamie filed 2 wrongful death suits against Alan, his wife Maureen, and others for $38 million. The lawsuits alleged that Alan initiated the plot to kill Sheila and also accused Maureen of participating in the conspiracy. The lawsuit also alleged that Alan moved all his stock and holdings just 2 weeks after Sheila's death in an attempt to hide money from her family. Finally, on January 4th in the year 2000, 44-year-old Alan was indicted by a federal grand jury in Texas. He was indicted on 1 count of conspiring to use interstate commerce and the commission of murder for hire, and 1 count of causing another to cross state lines to commit domestic violence. He was arrested the same day after playing a round of golf at a San Antonio country club. According to the Tampa Bay Times, Alan was tried in federal court instead of state court because, quote, federal prosecutors have the advantage in pursuing Blackthorne that state prosecutors would not have. In federal court, defense attorneys cannot take depositions of government witnesses, and they are limited in what evidence they get before trial. During some federal jury selections, defense attorneys don't talk to prospective jurors. The judge predominantly asks the questions. If Blackthorne had been tried in a Florida court, as anticipated, state prosecutors would have had a tougher time proving premeditated murder. For a first-degree murder conviction, the state would have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Rocha was specifically hired by Blackthorne, and Blackthorne could plead that he never wanted his former wife to die. End quote. Or it could be, as Ann Rule put it, the United Investigators called it a silver platter prosecution. Whoever had the best chance of putting Alan Blackthorne away got evidence from every investigator involved in both states, served on a silver platter. Plus, if Alan was acquitted at the federal level, he could still be charged in state court, in Texas, and in Florida. Alan Blackthorne was deemed a flight risk and was denied bail. As I told you, I did struggle with the structure of this case. Alan Blackthorne's trial was very interesting, and as far as I know, it was not taped for court TV, nor are there any full transcripts available. But if you want a full blow-by-blow, do read Ann Rule's book. She sat through the trial as she did on every case she wrote about. There was indeed a lot of complicated testimony proving the conspiracy, but according to rule, the jury never looked bored. They were riveted. There were a few interesting moments I will highlight. Trials are always unusual about what can and can't be entered into evidence. For instance, the baby's footprints in Sheila's blood were ruled too inflammatory. But Alan's attorney screwed up while grilling one criminalist about blood found on the boots that Joey Del Toro had worn. He asked if there had been any prints made in those boots. The second he asked this, prosecutors rushed to pull another criminalist back in who had already testified. She then entered the photos into evidence and testified about the heartbreaking baby footprints in Sheila's blood that she had photographed. Stevie and Daryl both testified against their father, and their testimony was excruciating. Daryl would testify again during his sentencing, saying she hoped he would rot in prison. Alan never once looked at either of his daughters while they were on the stand. And of course, being the incredible narcissist he was, Alan ignored the advice of his attorneys and testified on his own behalf. He held up well under his lawyer's direct questions, seemingly affable, calling his attorney by his first name. But his cross-examination got off to an electrifying start when he tried to address the prosecutor, John Murphy, as John while he was on the stand. "My name is Mr. Murphy," the prosecutor roared at Alan. And Alan withered under his cross-examination, each day looking smaller and more haggard, according to Ann Rule. Murphy blasted him, asking him if he had ever contacted his daughters again after their mother's murder. One dime, one phone call, anything. "No," Alan blubbered, saying his attorney said it could look like he was trying to bribe his daughters. Journalists apparently had bets on whether or not Alan Blackthorne would crack up on the stand. Many believed that a man with that size ego would blow. He never really did, and most guessed that he had been heavily drugged with Valium or some other tranquilizer during his cross-examination. He was too calm and very glassy-eyed. In the end, federal prosecutors, working closely with Florida and Texas investigators and DAs, built a magnificent case against Alan Blackthorne. They entered some 40 pieces of evidence of the conspiracy they proved. And still, the jurors carefully deliberated for 33 hours on Alan's case. They found Alan guilty on both counts, and he was sentenced to 2 life terms in federal prison without parole. One juror said Alan was, quote, blinded by his hate. He didn't think he would get caught. He was Alan Blackthorne. Nothing was going to happen to him. As his uncle Tom Oliver had told CBS News, Alan can't lose. Alan does not lose. Alan wins. Not this time. After his conviction, Alan Blackthorne spent time in a Texas federal prison where he was stabbed several times, including in one of his eyes, with a screwdriver by another inmate. But he survived. Then on November 20th, 2014, Alan died in the U.S. Penitentiary in Terre Haute, Indiana. He was 59 years old. His cause of death was not released. If there is a hell, I hope Alan Blackthorne is burning there with a golf club just out of his reach. Maureen Blackthorne was convicted of tax evasion in 2004 and had divorced Alan in 2005. I sincerely hope that she is living a miserable life in poverty, but I doubt it. I have no idea what happened to Alan's sons with Maureen. My hope is that they changed their names and moved on from the nightmare of their parents. Sheila Bellish would have been very sad to learn that her children did not all stay together. Daryl went to live with Carrie, Sheila's sister's family, and grew up alongside her cousins. Stevie stayed with Jamie to help with the quadruplets. Jamie evidently had trouble forgiving poor little Daryl, manipulated by Alan into giving him the name of the street they had lived on. Jamie did settle financially with Alan Blackthorne. A judge unfroze Alan's assets and his remaining stock in his company, worth about $4.5 million in 2001, was distributed among Sheila's children. I know the quadruplets spent some time growing up in Alabama, and Frank Bellish followed in Jamie's footsteps and joined the Marines. Stevie and Daryl both changed their names, and I did not look too far into where they are today. I just hope they have found some peace and happiness. Sheila Bellish was buried in New Jersey, where Jamie was from. He moved back there to be closer to his parents not long after her murder. I have known about Sheila's case since she was murdered when I was in my 20s. Haley had put her name on our topics list, and I almost burst into tears when I read it. It's been very difficult getting through this script without crying. I had never forgotten the hell that poor woman went through, nor how hard she fought for her life, for 10 years against Alan Blackthorne, refusing to ever give up. And then how she fought desperately against a brutal killer twice her size in the last 10 minutes of her life, before she died with the sounds of her baby's cries echoing in her ears. Southern Fried True Crime is written, hosted, and produced by me, Erica Kelly. Today's episode was researched by me and Haley Gray. Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio, and the original graphic art is by Coley Horner. If you or anyone you know is suffering from domestic violence or intimate partner abuse in the United States, please call the Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-7233. Services for the UK, Australia, and Canada are listed in today's show notes. You are not alone. If you want more information on this case, I cannot recommend Ann Rule's book enough. It's called Every Breath You Take. If you have any case suggestions, please visit my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com, and go to the Listener Suggestion tab. And if you have submitted a case suggestion in the last few months, please resubmit it on the website. I was very overwhelmed by email when I came back from my sick leave and never caught up. This is the best way for me to get to those little-known cases y'all always send me. And come join our Facebook group, Southern Fried True Crime Fans Discussion Group, where we swap recipes, worship Dolly Parton, and share memes. We do, of course, discuss true crime. Not just Southern Fried, but all kinds. But it is still very much a Southern lifestyle group. Our group is a safe and fun corner of Facebook, and by God, we mean it when we say no shit ass is allowed. It's not just a motto, it's how we run the group. If you enjoyed today's show, please don't forget to subscribe, and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on all large platforms like iHeart, Stitcher, and Spotify. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.